From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the future of the Rubicon Trail west of Lake Tahoe. Also, peacemaking in Africa. But first, a high-rise will soon tower over fields in South Placer County, part of a $1 billion expansion of Thunder Valley Casino. The 24-story building will be a hotel. Also planned are restaurants, spas, and a theater. Thunder Valley, owned by the United Auburn Indian Community, has been a big hit since it opened in 2003, although there were protests before it was built. How is the community responding to this expansion, and what impact will a much larger Thunder Valley have on South Placer County, in particular the casino's neighboring cities of Lincoln and Roseville? We'll start our discussion with a spokesman for the United Auburn Indian Community, the tribe that owns the casino. He's Doug Elmets. Doug, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Why is Thunder Valley spending so much money making itself bigger?
Well, one of the first things that occurred once the casino was originally opened in 2003 was, when are you going to build the hotel? Where's the entertainment? That was what we heard from our customers. So this is really that effort to try and meet that need.
But isn't there already a hotel there?
No, there's not a hotel there. It's simply wonderful restaurants, gaming space, and parking, but no hotel, no performing arts center, and now's the opportunity.
Why was the decision made to build up when it comes to the hotel?
Well, there's a confined amount of space. It's reservation land. It's called federal trust land, and there are essentially about 49 acres. There's not really an ability to go outwards. The only place to go is upwards. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this isn't an area that's zoned industrial. It's in the unincorporated area of Placer County. It's near the county waste dump, across the street from a manufacturing plant that makes pallets and a formica plant. So it's really pretty much out there in nowhere.
Doug Elmets, spokesman for the United Auburn Indian Community, the tribe that owns the Thunder Valley Casino in South Placer County. They hope to soon start a $1 billion expansion of the casino, including a high-rise hotel. On the phone is Robert Wygant, Placer County Supervisor. His District 2 includes the Thunder Valley Casino. Supervisor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How did you react when you heard about the plans for Thunder Valley?
Well, the most exciting part was going through the first project, because it was very controversial, and there wasn't any natural mechanism within the county to deal with the tribe in a constructive manner, so we sort of had to invent that in the face of tremendous controversy. So the expansion was not as dramatic, even though it's such a large project. It was comforting to know that we had a constructive working relationship with the tribe and a method by which we could accomplish quality land use planning.
Has the county gone to the tribe and said, we'd like you to do this, we'd like you to not do that in this planned expansion?
In the first experience, again, when there was no method for doing all of that, our goal at the county was simply to try and have a method by which the outcome of the tribe's projects, setting aside the question and controversy about gambling prospectively, how could we make sure that the project was like any other project that we would want in Placer County?
In other words, if someone else had proposed to build a 24-story hotel in unincorporated Placer County, would the County Board of Supervisors approve that?
I suspect they would under the same circumstances, yes.
Okay. Doug Elmets, how interested is the tribe, the United Auburn Indian Community, in negotiating with Placer County when it comes to this big expansion?
Well, the reality is that when the tribe entered into a memorandum of understanding with Placer County, it was hailed by the federal government as a model for how all tribes and local governments should work together. The United Auburn Indian Community was vilified by other tribes throughout the nation for doing this. The reality is now, today, all tribes in California that want to have a gaming enterprise like this have to have a local government agreement. The point being that we've got an outstanding relationship with Placer County, in part because we've mitigated a lot of impacts from this project, whether it's transportation, air quality, building standards. Those things really matter a lot to the county and clearly matter a lot to the tribe as well.
Supervisor Robert Wygant, would you agree that the tribe and the county have an outstanding relationship?
Yes. As it relates to the mitigation that Doug spoke to with the current project, they actually more than mitigated the impact of their project. They actually dramatically enhanced, for example, fire and police protection in the industrial park in which they're located. They built road improvements that were far beyond the capacity requirements for their project alone. Yes.
Doug Elmitz, you said earlier that some other gaming tribes did not like the memorandum of understanding that the United Auburn Indian community has. Why not?
Well, there are a lot of tribes throughout the country that believe that their reservations are essentially islands into themselves, and that outside influences should not have any effect on what goes on the reservation. You know, the United Auburn Indian community believes it's absolutely essential to work cooperatively with local governments, community groups, and individuals that might be impacted. And that's one of the reasons why this tribe and this casino have had a good relationship with the local governments, whether they be with Placer County, Rockland, Lincoln, Roseville, Auburn, communities around them.
We're talking about the imminent and large expansion of the Thunder Valley Casino in South Placer County. You've already heard from Doug Elmitz, who's a spokesman for the tribe that owns the casino, and Robert Wygant, Placer County Supervisor. Our third guest is Cheryl Schmidt. She's Director of Stand Up for California. It's a gambling watchdog group. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
You opposed the original construction of Thunder Valley. Why did you oppose it then?
The original project, it wasn't located on Highway 65 as it is now. We opposed the initial proposal, which was off of Interstate 80, and worked with our county supervisors, making the request that if there was a negotiated agreement, that the tribe would be appropriately located. And the tribe and the county worked together to find an appropriate location in an industrial park.
And you think that that is an appropriate location where the casino is now?
Absolutely. Okay. It is a negotiated, they negotiated the agreement, they negotiated the location, and for our efforts, we believe that the local land use agreement developed between the tribe and the county of Placer is a model for both the state of California and the nation.
What about the expansion that's going to start soon? Very large expansion, large high-rise hotel. What do you make of that?
Well, when any of these casinos begin to expand, and not just Thunder Valley, but any of them in the state today, they sort of the size and scope of the expansion takes your breath away. Unlike some of the other expansions that have happened in the past, Thunder Valley has this memorandum of understanding with the County of Placer. And they have, in the past, worked out, the mitigations of their impacts so that today, at the most recent hearing, there was only two or three speakers that even came forward to speak about the impacts, potential impacts on the surrounding community. Very different than some of the hearings that I've been to recent, where you have 800, 1,200 people show up to complain about potential impacts.
Cheryl, have any of your members or supporters or whatever said to you, no, we can't go with this. It's too big an expansion of a casino.
I've had individuals talk to me and be concerned about the expansion, but I've pointed out that the tribe will have to comply with the agreement that was negotiated with Placer County, and as far as I know, that's being adhered to.
Robert Wygant, what about your constituents? Have you heard from constituents in your District 2 who've said, I don't like this, it shouldn't happen?
Similar to Cheryl's answer, on the first go-round, the controversy was so intense that for a full 2 weeks before our hearing constituents left messages on my home answering machine that would fill it up every night, demanding that we simply fight the casino and the gambling and the project itself. This time, I've heard virtually nothing. I've had some conversations with colleagues in other local governments, Rockland, Roseville, Lincoln. We've discussed some of the technical issues as it relates to how mitigation should occur and the priority for road improvements, et cetera, sewage disposal, those kinds of things. But none of the wave of controversy that occurred in the first experience.
What about traffic and crime? Those are common concerns that people have about casinos. Are you worried about increases in those beyond what the area could handle?
No, I'm more worried again the last time because, you know, the project, including gambling, was an unknown. We didn't have any other gambling efforts in the county. So this time, after the first project has been built, again, the tribe built more road improvements than the impact from their casino. We have very good staff, and technically they will do a similar analysis as to last time, and I'm sure the tribe will contribute to the community as they have in the past. We had an experience at the casino where there was a woman who was murdered off-site from the casino, ended up getting into an automobile with someone she should not have, but because of the cooperation between Placer County Sheriff's Department and the United Auburn Indian community on the site, we actually were able to convict the murderer, and we have not even yet found the body. Had that happened anywhere else in Placer County, there would be a murderer still at large. And so the relationship is strong, and I think we'll continue to have those kinds of cooperative agreements. The tribe is very concerned about making sure that their casino is a desirable destination, and they've been very smart about working with us to accomplish those things.
Robert, I understand that you were born in Lincoln when it truly was a rural community. How do you feel when you imagine a 24-story building rising up over what obviously not that long ago was just fields?
Actually, I wasn't quite born here, but almost. But the height of the building is a provocative question. One of the key initiatives that I've been working on in recent years at the board is open space preservation. So the Placer County, in fact, does preserve its quality of life, including the rural component. So whereas this building is tall, it's a good thing that we're going to have denser development on less of a footprint. Mm-hmm. As it relates to its impact on the Sunset Industrial Area, which is the largest industrial complex in all of the county, cities or unincorporated, very important area for us for jobs creation, I think it actually will have a positive influence on attracting other kinds of business investments to that area.
Okay.
So as it relates to growth, generally, I look around and I have mixed emotions. I think generally in Placer County, we've done a good job of land use planning. You know, if I could wave a magic wand and have the county exist that I grew up in, I might do that. Some things are better, but there certainly are trade-offs with that. But as I do my job and contemplate growth and standards, it's a total package, and I think we've actually done a good job in the face of tremendous growth pressures.
And Doug Elmets, when will the expansion work start, and when do you expect it to be finished?
Well, we hope that the construction will begin sometime this summer, and it will probably take 18 months to 2 years. The great thing is that it's going to create 1,000 new construction jobs in an environment where those jobs are desperately needed, and then add an additional 1,000 employees to the casino base. So that brings it up to almost 3,000 employees. It becomes a real economic engine. And I'll just say one other thing, because I know you're probably ready to go, and that is that, you know, the casino right now pumps about $45 million into the local economy. They'll add an additional $25 million into the local economy by using local vendors. So it does become an economic engine.
And finally, Doug, is the tribe sketching out Any long-term expansion plans beyond this one?
No, this is this pretty much ties up the space on the existing land that's known as reservation land in Placer County.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking about the expansion, the big expansion of Thunder Valley Casino that starts soon in South Placer County. Thanks to Doug Elmett, spokesman for the United Auburn Indian Community, the tribe that owns the casino, Robert Wygant, Placer County Supervisor, whose district includes the casino, and Cheryl Schmidt, Director of Stand Up for California, a gambling watchdog group. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the future of the Rubicon Trail, specifically off-road traffic there. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight details at capradio.org/insight. Artists converge on two downtown Reno hotels this weekend to display and sell their work. The show is called Nada Motel. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll talk with an artist from her hotel room, which is also her exhibit space, and the organizer about their mission to get a room, make a show. Plus, Century 21's president is in town to talk about the Sacramento real estate market, and the band Be Brave Bold Robot will play live in our studio. What's the future of off-road driving on the Rubicon Trail, one of America's most famous four-wheel drive routes? There are more and more vehicles on the Rubicon, and some are much bigger and more powerful than the Jeeps of the past. What impact does this traffic have on the trail and the surrounding environment, and what rights do the various trail users have, both drivers and hikers? Let's start with Tom Celio. He's with El Dorado County. A large portion of the Rubicon Trail goes through El Dorado County, and the Rubicon Trail is, in fact, an unmanaged county road. Tom is Deputy Director for Maintenance Operations at the County's Department of Transportation, and he'll be overseeing the El Dorado County portion of the Rubicon Trail starting July 1st. Tom Celio, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Give us an idea of how the Rubicon Trail is doing today, at least the portion in El Dorado County.
It is busy, but it's doing quite well. I've been involved in the trail on the Rubicon Oversight Committee for a couple of years, and just recently been asked to get directly involved in managing, from the county's perspective, trail maintenance and a lot of the cooperative projects that we need to do up there.
When you say busy, has it been getting busier?
You know, I would say it's been pretty consistent for about the last 10 years. It just needs to be continually managed and maintained. And so that's our primary goal, is managing and maintaining the trail.
El Dorado County has started work on a management plan for its portion of the trail, but that work has been suspended because of budget problems, correct?
That's correct.
And that plan would have come up with rules for how to run the trail and also funding for restoration. Is that correct?
The management plan was a very comprehensive a document, and it did cover that and much more. And so recently, the Board of Supervisors, due to budget concerns, decided that we needed to table that just due to the fact it couldn't be afforded.
As a person who will be in charge of the maintenance of the Rubicon Trail, do you have enough money to do the work that you need to do?
I think that's to be determined. We're going to have to make best use of the resources we do have. We do have some relatively consistent funding, and so we're putting that to good use and partnering with volunteer groups, users of the trail, and the property owners, primarily the Forest Service and the private property owners, to do maintenance projects.
We're talking about the Rubicon Trail and what's ahead for it. My first guest, Tom Celio of El Dorado County Department of Transportation. Our next guest is the president of the Rubicon Trail Foundation. That's a group that supports off-road vehicle use of the trail. Randy Burleson, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
For those of our listeners who haven't been to the Rubicon Trail, give us a quick idea of where it is, where it starts, where it ends, and what's special about it.
Well, it's Rubicon's a historic trail that technically starts in Georgetown and goes all the way to Lake Tahoe via Rubicon Springs. It's now shorter than that because it's been paved a little bit at both ends, but it goes now more or less from Loon Lake to Lake Tahoe. It's a lot of granite, a lot of trees, a lot of nature, and some fun challenge in trail to get there.
What makes it so appealing to off-road vehicle users?
It's hard to put my finger on that. You meet cool people out there who are willing to help out if something goes wrong, willing to share your campground if something doesn't go wrong. It's challenge, it's nature, it's beauty, it's all kind of rolled up in one.
Is it correct that the vehicles that are being used on these trails are more powerful and bigger than they used to be?
Well, there's a range of vehicles used on the trail. There's the classic old Jeeps with smaller tires, and there's larger tube buggies with bigger tires and just about everything you could imagine in between.
Do the bigger vehicles with the bigger tires cause more of a problem to the trail itself and the surrounding area?
It all comes down to the guy behind the wheel.
How do you mean?
Bigger tires can conform to the terrain better and actually tread more lightly with less impact, but it all depends on how the driver operates. A guy with small tires can stomp on the gas and spin the tires just as well as a guy with big tires can.
What happens when someone does abuse their vehicle when they're on the Rubicon Trail? What consequences are there come from that? What do you see happen when it happens?
Generally, their vehicle breaks and needs repaired. But Friends of the Rubicon, another group with which I'm affiliated, has been working with the county to get cleanup spill kits and a lot of education and enforcement out there to help people understand that they need to clean up after themselves.
Randy Burleson of the Rubicon Trail Foundation. Also in our studio is Bill Marshall, who's section chief of the Stormwater Program at the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Central Valley Region. Did I get that right?
Thank you. Yes, you did.
How does the Water Quality Control Board have an interest in the Rubicon Trail?
Well, we have an interest throughout the Central Valley in water quality, and we received a few complaints about siltation and spillage of vehicle fluids into the surface waters, and so that would concern us if there was water pollution going on and it was being actively augmented by people using the trail. I mean, we would be concerned about that.
Has there been an increase in complaints like that?
I would say yes, over the past couple of years.
Has there been an increase in the seriousness of the complaints?
I would say yes. The complaints are coming very quickly, and many pictures are being sent in to us and showing the activities.
So you have photographs. I was just going to ask you how you know or how you believe why you would think that it was the vehicles that was causing the problem, because presumably there are a lot of people out on the Rubicon Trail.
Oh, I'm sure there are a lot of vehicles on the trail. We've seen that on the websites, but the photographs do show in some cases where fluids are coming out of vehicles, showing some vehicles in waterways or water areas, and causing some problems in those areas. However, we really haven't gone out there to this point to make our own evaluation. And you know, in order to really be fair, we have to go out there and look at the waterways and see what kind of problems are actually taking place.
Randy Burleson, do you agree that there's a problem here? And whether or not, what do you think should be done about the water supplies that are in the vicinity of the Rubicon Trail?
Well, the water supplies are, I think, in good shape. I see fish downstream spawning with success. Lots of wildlife drinking from it. There are occasional spills. We do have cleanup kits. People seem to clean up after themselves. And I feel like this problem is being well addressed through our ongoing enforcement and education efforts.
Tom Celio, from the point of view of El Dorado County, do you have Does the county have a stake in this particular issue here, the water and apparent contamination of water associated with the Rubicon Trail?
We certainly have a stake in it, for sure. Our primary goal is to maintain and also do any capital improvements that would keep primarily sediment and or any vehicle fluids out of stream channels. We have two bridge projects. The county really stepped up to the plate and recommended two bridge projects to be built on two of the primary streams up there. And we're moving forward with those and expect within the next 2 to 3 years to have them in place.
We're talking about the Rubicon Trail west of Lake Tahoe, how it's managed today, how it could be managed differently in the future of off-road vehicles there, and so on. Our fourth and final guest on the topic joins us by phone. She's Karen Schambach, California Field Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Karen, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
What's your take on the state of the Rubicon Trail?
Well, I guess the first point I'd like to make is that we disagree that the management plan was dropped because of a lack of funding. The county spent over $400,000 over the last 7 years on the plan, and now they need, all that was left was to make a decision, and we think it was more a lack of political will than a lack of funding, because once adopted, user fees would be available to manage the trail. We also think that the existing use is not sustainable. You know, I've lived in Georgetown for 25 years, and for several decades, people used the trail as a thoroughfare between Georgetown and Lake Tahoe. It also allowed them to enjoy the high country scenery and recreation. In fact, in the 1920s, an old DOT road inspector, Frank Shin, used to drive a hard-wheeled milk truck on the trail from Georgetown to Lake Tahoe. But the dominant use now are these trucks on steroids who use the alpine environment as a test of who has the meanest machine. And in many cases, this involves driving off the trail or driving in extremely muddy conditions or even over each other's vehicles. This has damaged the trail so that portions are now only passable by specialized rigs with highly modified suspension systems.
Would you, Karen, would you remove vehicles from the Rubicon Trail or just restrict the kind of vehicles that could use the Rubicon Trail?
What we would like to see is the trail restored to the condition that allowed normal high-clearance vehicles to make the trip and to restore the trail as a place where people can take their kids camping and fishing and hiking and enjoy the high country in a sustainable way. We don't have any desire to get, you know, all vehicles off the trail, but we think that the type of vehicle that dominates the trail now is not sustainable. People... The trail has gotten so eroded that the people with the smaller wheels can't use, you know, many portions of the trail, and so they create bypasses where they actually go around the rutted sections, which further destroys vegetation mm-hmm. and increases erosion. So we want the original trail restored to a condition that allows, you know, a normal Jeep-type vehicle to get through it and... recreate the sustainable experience that is so important to the economy of Georgetown.
Okay. Randy Burleson, how do you respond to that? Karen Schambach says that she would like to see the trail restored to the way that it was, not eliminating vehicles, but just restoring it to the way it was in the past when it was okay for smaller vehicles, but not, as she called it, the vehicles and steroids.
I don't think it's even remotely practical to take the trail back to the days of 1920s milk truck. I drive a fairly middle-of-the-road vehicle. Other folks in my club have vehicles with 31 and 33-inch tires. People can and do recreate on the Rubicon regularly with small tires. They can and do stay on the trail. People with large tires also stay on the trail. There are a few people who are offending, and luckily we have better law enforcement present than ever this year, and that's how we need to address people going off the trail.
How interested are vehicle users in self-policing?
You'd be surprised. There's been a growing Rubicon Trail Patrol presence, which is volunteers working with each other We have informational kiosks at Loon Lake and handouts. People are stopping to talk, to participate, to get cleanup kits, to get maps so that they know where the trail is so that they can stay on it.
Tom Celia, I want to pick up on something else that Karen Schambach said. She said she didn't believe that El Dorado County dropped its work on the management plan for the Rubicon Trail because of budget reasons. Can you respond to that?
I think all I can say in regard to that is I was at the budget hearings, given that it was a part of our department's responsibility. I was there when they voted and when the discussion took place at the Board of Supervisors. And it was clear to me that they saw some very high numbers in regard to implementing the master plan. So what we've been asked to do is come in and manage the trail in a cost-effective, reasonable manner and really pay close attention to the things that need immediate work. And so that's what we're doing, partnering with the Forest Service and user groups and the private property owners.
Bill Marshall, what would the California Regional Water Quality Control Board like to see happen with the Rubicon Trail? Any restrictions on vehicles or the like?
Well, our goal is not to place restrictions on the vehicles using the trail, but our goal is primarily to protect water quality. Our goal is to protect water quality. And so, we would like to see that it be used responsibly and that there be some kind of more enforcement, maybe.
And who would that be?
I'm not sure. The Forest Service, of course, is not involved directly with the trail. But if people get off the trail, then the Forest Service can be involved, and they do. They are involved to a certain extent. Not sure exactly who would be at this point. Who would be involved in any enforcement efforts on the trail?
Karen Schambach, you've already addressed what you would like to see on the trail, but any other thoughts? You can respond to what you've heard since you last spoke, or give us some other idea of what you would like to see done on the Rubicon Trail.
Oh, yeah, I guess a couple of things. One, I don't think that the Board of Supervisors ever voted on this. All we've seen is some anecdotal remarks made in a meeting that they weren't going to continue, but there was never any, this has never been formally abandoned. The other thing is, I don't expect the trail to be restored to the condition that a milk truck could pass, but when it gets difficult for even, a normal with a normal Jeep without being highly modified, they can't do the trail. There are places. It's become a spectator sport where people gather around Spider Lake and watch people trying to do a spot called Little Sluice. And so there are bypasses there because a normal vehicle, even a Jeep, stock Jeep, can't get through there. It's become what you see at a fairground where you have the monster trucks battling each other. It's become a spectator sport, and we believe that our public lands, and this is the El Dorado National Forest. Once they, the trail is a county road going through the forest, but it's still public lands, and we think that the kind of activity that takes place at Little Sluice is better suited for a the fairgrounds or some place. They don't need a thoroughfare in order to do that kind of activity. Mm-hmm. I guess the one last thing I'd like to say is that, if you go up there, and I'm sure Mr. Marshall will observe this, the trail smells like an old garage. There's so much petroleum products that have been spilled there that you can follow the trail of transmission fluid and hydraulic fluid, and because they damp these, even the highly modified vehicles, in trying to get over some of these rocks that have been exposed through the erosion, damage their undercarriages and rip out their hoses and other hydraulic lines and things like that. So the place reeks, and when you consider that this is the same environment as Desolation Wilderness, it's very similar. It's a high alpine with lots of alpine lakes. And it's extremely beautiful. I don't blame people for wanting to go up there, and I wouldn't discourage people from going up there. But I think that it's way overdue for being properly managed.
Okay.
And it's time for somebody to take it in hand and do it.
Randy Burleson, the El Dorado National Forest, as I understand, is reducing by about 1,000 miles the amount of off-road vehicle space in the forest, and not including the Rubicon Trail. And another organization that you mentioned, Friends of the Rubicon, and on its website says the Rubicon Trail is threatened with closure. Do off-road vehicle users in El Dorado National Forest area, are they worried that the tide is moving against them?
Very much so, and it's not just El Dorado National Forest. It's everywhere nationally. The Forest Service nationally is working route designation or travel management to restrict OHV access to trails. The 1,000 miles that you mentioned for El Dorado is 1,000 miles since the inventory. There's actually almost 1,000 miles that was lost before then. Many of the local users are very concerned about that and are thus very active politically and very active, again, to work with the agencies to help maintain the resources.
And finally, Tom Celio, will the El Dorado County Master Plan for the Rubicon Trail be revived?
You know, I can't answer that question for you today. I know that much of the information in there is very useful. We are using some of that information to help us make good decisions up on the trail. But the primary thing is El Dorado County is stepping up to the plate big time and partnering with the state and federal agencies to get a grip on this and do a good job to manage the trail. And one of our primary goals is to keep the trail open.
Well, thank you all very much. That was Tom Celio, Deputy Director for Maintenance Operations at the El Dorado County Department of Transportation. He'll be overseeing the El Dorado County portion of the Rubicon Trail starting July 1st. Also in our studio, Randy Burleson, President of the Rubicon Trail Foundation. It's a group that supports off-road vehicle use of the trail. And Bill Marshall, Section Chief of the Stormwater Program at the California Regional Water Quality Control Board. And on the phone, Karen Schambach, California Field Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, peacemaking in Africa. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did something on Insight particularly please you? Email us and tell us what it was and why you liked it so much at insight@capradio.org. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, state and local fire officials announce fines and penalties for selling illegal fireworks. That story later today on All Things Considered. Africa has suffered some of the worst violence and corruption in the world in recent decades. Perhaps Sudan comes first to mind, or Rwanda. But other countries have seen terrible trouble too, including Burundi. A group called the African Great Lakes Initiative promotes peace in Central Africa. It's a Quaker organization. One of its leaders is in Sacramento today to talk about the African Great Lakes Initiative's work, helping former enemies reconcile in countries like Rwanda, Burundi, and Kenya. He's in our studio. David Zaremka, welcome to Insight.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
How do you bring people who are mortal enemies together so that they can somehow heal and reconcile?
Well, it's not easy.
I guess.
But what we do is we do a three-day workshop with about 20 people. We try to get 10 from each side because you want to have a balanced number of people. And when they start, one's group's on one side, the other group's on the other side. They don't greet each other. They don't talk to each other. They don't make eye contact. And by the end of 3 days, we've got them being friends again, as they may have been before, say, the genocide in Rwanda.
And how do you bring these people together? Who says you're welcome? Who says you can do it? How do you find the people?
Well, we find many people want to come. And usually it's because they've been burdened by the trauma that they've had, and they want to move on. And so it's those people who are willing to come to our workshop. Some people aren't willing to come. And We do a lot of experiential kind of things, games, small group discussions, things like that, which forces people to mix together. There's no didactic kind of work and, you know, lessons like teacher-student kind of things.
What's usually the turning point for people in this situation? What is it, in your experience, that usually makes them tip over into understanding their former enemy rather than seeing that person as a person they hate?
Okay, the first day we deal with trauma and what symptoms, how people react to it and this and that. The second morning, we do grief. And we go through a session where we have people go through a grief process. And everybody's been affected negatively, both victims and perpetrators. And so there's a certain commonality. And at the end of that session, people hardly, I mean, they're really down. So then we have to spend the rest of the second day building them up. But by the time you've built them back up again, they've gone through an experience together that somehow bonds them.
How do you know it's making a difference?
Oh, we get testimonies continuously about the difference that our workshops make. One of the most common ones is that a husband will say, well, I stopped beating my wife and my kids after coming to the workshop. So you say, well, maybe he's just trying to say something nice. So you go ask the wife, and the wife will say, oh, my husband's completely changed. He used to come home, and he never would talk to us, and he would beat us, and he would yell at the kids. Now he comes home, ask us how we're doing, ask the kids what they've done for the day. And this is the kind of change, amazing change for just a three-day workshop, I would say.
Must be very satisfying.
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, these are really traumatized societies and people, but working with them, you always come back with a real feeling of hope and encouragement because you see the resilience of humans.
My guest is David Zaremka. He's coordinator of the African Great Lakes Initiative, a Quaker group. He's speaking in Sacramento tonight at the Friends Meeting House in East Sacramento. And specifically, he's talking about healing emotional wounds in countries like Rwanda, Burundi, and Kenya. Also with us is Salome Wamea. She's from Kenya and lives in Sacramento. She's also a Quaker and helped organize David Zaremka's visit to Sacramento for his talk tonight. Salome Wamea, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How are things in Kenya today? It is not a country that we think of as having anything like the violence of Rwanda and Burundi, but there was trouble in Kenya after the elections at the end of last year.
Yeah, it was very chaotic. I was watching the news, and usually you read about things happening in other countries, and Kenya was in the news a lot every day, and it was just something I couldn't believe that it was happening.
Have you been back to Kenya since the election and the trouble?
No, I haven't been since the election and the trouble. I was in Kenya in 2004,
yes.
And it was very stable. Things seems to be, everything looked okay. I couldn't imagine that something of that magnitude would be happening to Kenya.
How do you think people are doing today in Kenya? Is there still tension because of the divisions over the election?
Well, it's quieted down some from what I read in the news and reading David's newsletters and talking to relatives at home. I think it's quieted down, but it's just waiting to erupt. I think it's not fully stable.
David, tell us a little bit about your work in Kenya. It seems like it's a very different scale from what happened in Rwanda and Burundi with the long-standing tensions between the Hutu and the Tutsi.
Well, I started working with issues in Rwanda in 1964 when I took a year off from college. And what these small, seemingly small kinds of conflicts, when they're cycles, and when they reoccur, each cycle becomes more and more intense, which is what happened in Rwanda. It's also what happened in Burundi. The same thing can happen in Kenya. This was sort of a wake-up call, I think, for many Kenyans. But the question is, how are they going to respond? How is the government going to respond if it's just everything goes back to normal, what is called normal, and none of the root causes are dealt with? Then in the next election in 2012, there's likely to be another cycle, and it probably will be worse than this one.
Salome, are there long-standing ethnic divisions in Kenya?
There seem to be, because there was two winners in the election last year, and they were from different ethnic groups, and it was purely, you know, it was somebody won because he came from another tribe, controlling tribe. That's what I thought.
Mm. David, is it easier or harder to heal the divisions in Kenya compared to the greater violence that there was in Rwanda and Burundi?
Well, actually, I think Kenya might be more difficult. Rwanda and Burundi, I don't know if it's easier, but the fact is everybody saw what happened and they're really afraid. And particularly mothers see their kids fighting, kids of the other ethnic group, and they say, what's going to happen when these kids grow up? Well, we're going to have another cycle of violence. So in Rwanda and Burundi, people are really very intense upon trying to solve the ethnic divisions and make a stable government and a country. In Kenya, I'm not certain if that's for, like, church groups, many NGOs, many citizens, but the government and the big NGOs, they want business, wants things just to go back to normal and sort of life continue the way it was supposed to have been before. But if those root causes, which are things like youth alienation, economic disparity, land issues, things of this sort, aren't dealt with, then the underlying causes are still there and there's likely to be another time.
Salome, is it hard to hear this about your native country? Is this hard to accept?
Yeah, it's hard to accept, but, you know, change is on the way and, you know, this is not going to go on forever and ever, you know. So with what David is doing, you know, slowly by slowly, you know, things are going to change. Things I can see things turning around.
You have a longstanding connection with David Zaremka, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us about that?
I was very new to this country. I came to this country in 1979, and I had been in this country for 1 month. And in Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, used to be a Benjamin Wekesa, and was a good family friend to my family back home. And he invited me to come to Pennsylvania because he was like my dad. So he wanted me to come to Pennsylvania so I can do shopping for me. And it happened to be David's house that I came to.
That was quite some time ago, David.
Yes, I forgot all about it.
Have you kept up with each other?
No, not that. This Ben Wakesa that was our mutual friend, yes, we've kept up with a little bit, but I didn't keep up with her, no.
So when you saw each other, was it just today you saw each other again for the first time in a long time?
Yes, it was. I can understand a lot of students, people came through David's house that he couldn't keep up, you know, so I remembered him, but he could not. It's because there was so much going on and I was just new to the country. I can go back and remember what happened that day, but there's so many people coming and going in his, you know, in his house, being what he is. So I can understand why you did not remember me.
You were also only 20 years old.
Very good. You know, I just have to squeeze in this one last question. We're going to have to be very quick. I read that there are a lot of Quakers in Kenya, and there are more Quakers in Kenya than any other country in the world. I didn't know that. Do you know why that is?
Well, the Quaker missionaries went to Kenya in 1902 as one of the first groups, and they went to Western province of Kenya, which is where most of them are still today. And there wasn't, let us say, there wasn't much competition at that point. And so they had lots of converts, and so there's many of them, and there's more than there are in the United States now.
Yes. Well, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much, David Zaremka, coordinator of the African Great Lakes Initiative. It's a Quaker group. He's speaking in Sacramento tonight at 7 at the Friends Meeting House in East Sacramento. Also with us from Kenya, living now in Sacramento, also a Quaker, Salome Wamea. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Donna Lee, Lynn Weaver, and Jason Treadway. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, the assistant producer Robin Souza, the senior producer Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Artists converge on two downtown Reno hotels this weekend to display and sell their work. The show's called Nada Motel. On the next Insight, we'll talk with an artist from her hotel room and the organizer about their mission to get a room, make a show. Plus, Century 21's president is in Sacramento to talk about the local real estate market. And Be Brave, Bold Robot performs live in our studio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.